Good afternoon, and welcome to On the Docket. I'm Patricia Salkin, Dean of Touro Law Center in Central Islip. Every Sunday at this time, we talk about current legal issues and how they affect you. Today on the docket, we are talking about cybercrime and how to protect yourself and your family from cyber predators. When most people think about cybercrime, we think about stolen passwords, website hacks, and email scams limited to our activity on the internet. But cyber criminals are hitting brick and mortar stores too, such as the recent incident at Target this holiday season, where as many as 40 million credit and debit card users had their information compromised. As our cybercrime experts, today we have Touro Law Professors Jonathan Ezor and Michelle Zacharin. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
First, we'll start with Jonathan. Jonathan is director of the Touro Law Center's Institute for Business Law and Technology and an assistant professor of law. He also serves as counsel to Olshan, Frome, and Woloski, a full-service business law firm based in Manhattan. He's written extensively on cybercrime and related issues. Thank you for being on the show today, Jonathan.
Of course.
I should also add that both you and Michelle Zacharin teach a cyber law course at Touro Law Center. Jonathan, can you tell us a little bit about what happened at Target?
Sure. As the news stories reflected, someone maliciously hacked into the computers that Target uses for credit card processing. So this was not a situation where these credit card numbers were being stolen through the scanners. This was actually behind the scenes, which is why it became so massive. And so everyone in that time frame who was using a credit or debit card to pay for a purchase potentially had their numbers taken. It wasn't clear whether PIN numbers that were punched in for debit cards were also captured, but I believe from what I've read, given at what point in the processing the malicious hack took effect, that PIN numbers were at least potentially taken as well. So since then, there have been a number of news reports that those numbers, the databases of Target credit card numbers, have been sold or being offered around the world, and most of the major card issuers have taken it upon themselves to reissue new cards to those customers who may have been affected by it.
40 million credit cards all at one time, that's a lot. What should customers be watching for, and is this still an issue from things that an incident that happened in December?
It certainly can be an issue. Although some issuers did proactively send out new cards, I don't know that every single potential card issuer has done so. So it's entirely possible that customers may still be using the same card numbers, and those databases are still available for sale. It can very much be an issue. I should mention that it's a little bit different in terms of the exposure, the risk, for credit cards versus debit cards, even though people use them often interchangeably. The law better protects credit card users. That the statutory limits, the law that says how much you might be exposed to or less, the amount of time that you have protection is greater. And more to the point, just from a functional standpoint, when one uses a credit card, it's the issuing bank's money that's at risk, right? Because the issuing bank lays out the money and then bills the customer. When a customer uses a debit card, it's the customer's own bank account that's immediately at risk. So practically speaking, legally speaking, the debit card users may be in worse shape than the credit card users. But anyone who suspects that he or she may have had a credit card number taken because he or she shopped at Target should just request a new card from the bank, credit or debit. And also, absolutely, many of us don't look at our statements on a regular basis. Maybe we've got them set to auto pay. Look at your statement, not only your credit card statement, but your bank statement to see if there are any unexpected charges. That's always a good idea, but especially in a situation like this.
Absolutely. So you raised a really good point about the difference, legal difference between a credit card and a debit card and liability. But I've noticed that nowadays lots of banks, when they issue you a debit card, it also doubles as a credit card, and you have the option at the point of sale to decide if you're going to pay by credit or debit. Are those rules the same for the card that covers both? It's just what the consumer selects?
To my knowledge, that's right. That even though you may say, please treat it as a credit card, so don't make me put in my PIN, right, bill it as if it's a MasterCard or a Visa, it's still a debit card. And there is no one's money other than the consumer's own money that's being taken immediately to pay that bill.
Right. So very important to remember when the bank asks you if you want a debit card for your account, think about how you're going to use it. And using it at the ATM machine is way different than using it at the grocery store, using it at some other retail shop.
In fact, consumers can ask their banks often to not give them debit cards in the sense with a Visa or MasterCard logo, to give them an old-fashioned ATM card. You can still use it as a debit card at the grocery store, but it can't be used just to swipe. It can't be used online in the same way. It's an extra level of protection.
Yeah. Good point. Another issue that you've seen is lost and stolen devices, especially given how much of our lives are contained on our small phones, our handheld devices, and tablets. What should people do to protect themselves and their information in case of theft?
It would be nice to say, don't put anything sensitive on your phone or your tablet or on your laptop, but that's not realistic. Whether it's home personal information or work information, those devices are containing all of those things. So here, there are a couple of really straightforward tricks, and this is not a law issue as much as it's a risk management issue. For one thing, almost every device that's connected to the internet comes with some way of remotely wiping it, that you can either send it a text message or go online and say, the next time that device connects to the internet, automatically erase everything. So even if you won't necessarily get back the phone, if it's stolen and resold, the data will not be available for easy theft. And that can be true even if your phone or your tablet has a built-in memory card, or rather a removable memory card. It can still be set to remotely wipe. If you're a workplace and workers are connecting to your email server with their devices, workplaces can set in place automatic policies on those email servers so that any employee who wants to also enables the workplace to remotely wipe, because sometimes these are business data that are on the devices. It's also useful to encrypt, to scramble the information that's on there wherever possible. And there, whatever device you're using, there's going to be software that scrambles it so that unless you put in a PIN code or a password, and everyone should password enable their phones. If it's too inconvenient to do it every time you turn it on, set it to automatically reset after 10 minutes, whatever it is. So that if you just leave it somewhere, someone picks it up, they don't know your password or your PIN code. Most of those devices too, you put in the wrong one three or four, five times, whatever it's set, it will erase itself. Mm-hmm. But even with information on the device, you can put an additional password on some of it, so that someone with the phone still can't get at the very sensitive stuff, social security numbers. We're not even talking about those embarrassing photos that you perhaps don't want to get out there. We're talking really about personal information that can be used to directly take your money, damage your reputation, or help someone pretend to be you to your bank, to other people. So encryption is available on every device. Remote access and wiping available on every device, and absolutely passwords. They're things that too many people just don't turn on because they haven't thought about it, but they can so incredibly reduce the risks that come with a lost or stolen device.
So when you go to the store to buy a smartphone or to buy a handheld device, does the customer care agent working with the consumer, do they ever explain this information, or how does the average person know what to do? I think most people do put the passwords on their phones now, although I've seen lots of people walking around that don't. But who's educating people on what to do?
Well, certainly shows like this. A lot of the publications, whether it's for senior citizens or children or parents or other people, are getting the word out. I think that the device manufacturers are. And I haven't purchased a phone at retail recently, but I suspect that the customer care people, particularly if they're asked, will be able to lead users through in the setup how to turn on those encryption and password and delete features.
Right. Lots of great information. I hope that listeners were paying attention and really take heart. I want to thank you, Jonathan Ezor. Please stay with us because coming up, we'll talk to Michelle Zakharin. You're listening to On the Docket with Torah Law Dean Patricia Salkin on Long Island News 103.9. Welcome back to On the Docket. I'm here with Jonathan Ezor, professor at Torah Law Center, and we're talking about cybercrime. We're thrilled to also have Michelle Zakharin on the show today. Welcome, Michelle.
Thank you.
Michelle is a Torah Law graduate and is now professor at Torah Law, where she teaches cyber law and cybercrime, among other courses. So, Michelle, we've just heard from Jonathan Ezor about how cyber criminals can steal information from victims through computer hackings, but there's a whole other element of cybercrime and maybe multiple elements of cybercrime. Many cyber criminals nowadays are also using what's called social engineering to deceive people into sharing their own personal information. First, can you explain what this is and tell us what people's personal vulnerabilities are?
Yeah, sure. This is happening regularly. It's very common these days. The people's vulnerabilities are that they're trusting and they want to make sure they're doing the right thing and that they're complying with laws and that they're up to date. And unfortunately, scammers know that people want to report things and be trusting. And so they prey on certain people who really can otherwise be very, very smart. It's just that they're a trusting group of people. And through often it's through emails. It's called phishing scams with a PH. And it's often through emails that look legit. They look great. They look very trustworthy. And they send them out and they speak to the person personally. They speak to the person by name. They look like they're coming from a reputable source, often a bank. Sometimes it's your place of work is listed in there, and it feels real and it feels right. And what happens is people log on, will click through to this email, look at it, and it will often contain a link to go somewhere to give in some personal information. Almost as a threat, if you don't, then you may lose money or you may lose your access to your email accounts or something at work it's urgent, you must do this. And so people for good reasons do unfortunately click on, and often these sites where they're taken contain malware, which can be very damaging and also gives them the opportunity to give in certain information that they should never give in, like their own passwords, like social security numbers or bank account numbers or credit card information. And so through that, the scammers are obtaining people's data. And it's just people don't, unfortunately, the consumers don't know that it is until it's too late that right. It was a scam.
It's much more sophisticated than you've won a trip.
Okay. It's become more, yes.
And give us your credit card information. You know, we're not going to charge it, but we have to verify something. And I think that when people get these, there's often logos on there as well from banks, and
absolutely,
they use the real names.
Sure. You also get a combination where, and this is becoming fairly common too, someone will telephone, your phone will ring, and someone will claim to be from Microsoft or something that sounds like Microsoft, that we've detected some problems and we'd like to provide you with some remote computer support. And they lead you through on your own computer by phone the process of enabling them to remotely access your computer. And once that's done, anything from they're stealing data or they then cause the problem that they offer to charge to fix.
Right.
And the bottom line on that is you should never if you get a call as opposed to make a call to a verified customer service number, anyone who calls you and offers computer help, never ever provide remote access to your computer, no matter how official it sounds or how unskilled at fixing your computer you may be.
Right. And I did hear reports of scammers jumping on the bandwagon after the Target case that you were talking about earlier, claiming to be Target or claiming to be explaining that, oh, we think you may have been one of the customers who was affected by this. So report all your information here so we can make sure that you're not in our system. And so people who are afraid and they hear about this in the news, they might think, even if it's something tells them, well, I know I shouldn't, they still feel like there's a compelling reason to do so when it looks so trusting.
Right. So when you get a phone call, the first thing you should do is say, I can't talk to you right now. Either
I'll
hang up or ask for a number to call back and
exactly
wait. And when you get an email, delete. And if you're not sure if you should delete it, you can certainly ask somebody else. Oftentimes you can call your bank and say, are you sending out these emails? But, Michelle, what should people do? Where could they report it? Is there any central repository, or who do you call when this happens?
So a lot of the local police areas do have some cybercrime units now that they are hoping that people will report it through them. And there are also federal units, too, that depending on what type of particular scam this is, that sometimes federal agencies will get involved with it as well. But certainly report it to the police and call the establishment where you think it may be coming from. Yes, to verify and also to alert the company that these things are being done and just to put them on notice.
Mm-hmm. So let's say that somebody falls for the scam. And oftentimes you have people that are embarrassed that they've fallen for the scam and they don't want to notify somebody else because they're embarrassed that they did something wrong. But what are the risks and legal issues here, and can they get help if they report it?
Well, if the credit card, back to what we talked about earlier, if it results in a stolen credit card number, happily there's pretty good legal protection. You probably won't be liable for those charges. But if it's identification information, social security number, personal information, whatever it is, that may lead to identity theft, and that can permanently destroy your credit. It can allow people to empty out bank accounts. At that point, whatever the embarrassment, it's crucial to notify not only the police or the federal authorities, mm-hmm. but your bank, your place of work, anyone who otherwise might depend on that information to verify you and say it's been compromised. Everyone is entitled to a free credit report from the three credit rating agencies every year. It's always a good idea to get it, but especially if you think you've been a victim of this, to see if your credit has been impacted on it. Also watch the news, because if you've been affected, a lot of other people have too. And sometimes there will be collective remedies that you can take advantage of.
So here on Long Island, we have lots of small businesses. What kind of exposure is there for the small business owner?
Small businesses need to keep in mind that even if they don't have the budget for expensive IT departments, that their customer information may be more vulnerable as a result, and their reputations and their startup businesses, which don't have huge amounts of money to lose, may be affected, and their employee information, for which they're also responsible. Mm-hmm. Certainly, if it's a healthcare provider, they've got legal privacy obligations, financial services, and the like, but everybody. So there are a few things that any small business owner, particularly a startup business, can consider. One is, rather than configuring one's own systems, use a large provider, at least at first, who may be allowing you to do email and e-commerce services, where you get take advantage of the large provider's resources for security. It may seem less expensive at first to set up your own computer and use your own home internet connection, but ultimately, the risks are very large. Another thing that small businesses can consider is their insurance coverage. Insurance is a really great way of, if not avoiding risks, then at least providing some backup if bad things occur. And as part of your general conversation with your insurance broker or your carrier for other business liability, ask about e-commerce liability or cyber liability. If you're a small business, the premiums are probably very low. But again, the exposure can wipe out your entire business. And we shouldn't forget, good business practices, if you're setting up your small business, make sure you set it up as a separate corporation or a limited liability company, so that whatever its exposure is mm-hmm. won't affect your family's, your mortgage, your ability to keep your house, that the business will be separate from your personal money. That's always a good idea, cyber risk or other risks.
Right. And there recently were stories in the news with some small startups being targeted by bigger company, by scammers for ransom, and basically threatening to crash the site that is needed for the web, for the website that the small business owns, if money isn't paid. And when money isn't paid, it actually did. There are instances where the site did crash and it stayed it could not be turned back on. It couldn't be resolved for about a week. And so these are new scams that are coming up, cyber related, that are just, another threat. And they say to report those, don't necessarily pay it, report it and try and stick it out. So
we're constantly being vigilant to watch for the next latest scam.
And yes. don't forget to back up your data, personal or your business, so that if one computer is gone, at least mm-hmm. you've still got the record somewhere else.
Lots of great advice, and it is scary out there in cyber world. And I just want to say that at Toro Law Center, in our cyber law, cyber crimes class, we actually were oversubscribed this year and had to divide the class into two sections, which just goes to show the enormous interest in this area in the law. I want to thank Jonathan Ezor and Michelle Zacharin. It was a pleasure to have you both on the show.
Very welcome.
Thank you.
And thanks out there for listening. Remember, On the Docket airs every Sunday at 4:30 on Long Island News 103.9. So until next Sunday, this is Patricia Salkin, Dean of Toro Law Center. Have a great week.